Watch those vowels movements. It's time for another flat chat. The latest issue of GP Racing is on the shelves. Has been for quite a while, actually, because punctuality is not our strong point on this podcast. In the grand tradition of big news happening between us hitting print and the magazine appearing in your hands, big news has indeed happened. And we'll be talking about a few of those things. We're up-speeding ourselves. First up, Mercedes chief strategist James Vowles has taken the vacant team principal role at Williams, a move not many people expected. Indeed, when I interviewed Rob Smedley, the former chief engineer, on stage at the Autosport show, he said he was actually quite relieved because he was getting fed up with people claiming he was up for the job and getting loads of text messages saying, "So when do you start then?" Joining me to analyse this as well as a typically packed issue of GP Racing are, he's not in the US anymore, it's Mark Gallagher. G'day, Cobber. Good evening, Cobber.
Good evening to you. Very nice to be able to join you this evening from here just outside Adelaide. And sorry for being the person responsible for the delay in this podcast being recorded. It would help if I could add and subtract more efficiently when I'm working out time zone differences for recording this. So apologies for last week, and it's all my fault, listeners, that Stuart's been delayed.
After all this time crossing time zones, it never ceases to surprise especially when you're trying to work out when to phone home when you're away, isn't it? You sort of think, hang on.
Crossing the international dateline is properly confusing, and I fell into error 1.0, which is forgetting that when you get to America from Australia, you have to start counting the hours in the opposite direction when you want to talk to someone in London.
If memory serves, Phileas Fogg had a similar issue in Around the World from 80 Days. But, speaking of Fogg's, no longer the Fogg on the Tyne, because he's moved to the Midlands. It's Matt Q.
Absolutely. Hello, Connors. I'll take leave from Mark and apologise for the half an hour delay to recording this morning because I've had a technology shunt. So racing drivers have racing drivers' excuses. So podcasters should have podcasters' excuses, which is in the shunt, the Word document I had crafted with all my sage notes and prompts and just class-leading insight. They've all been deleted to the ether. I don't know where they've gone, so I'm afraid this is all off the cuff, and if I'm stuttery or lose my way or not quite as brilliant as normal, Collins, then I hope you and the listeners indeed understand why.
Mark, in your column this month, you talk about the era of the renter manager, not quite as entertaining as renter ghost. You highlighted the Williams decapitation. I think that's a joke that worked better on the printed page than spoken out loud.
Yeah.
one of the big question marks over that team's direction. On the face of it, sending a strategist to do a manager's job seems like a peculiar call.
The whole thing has really been quite shocking to behold. I was thinking the other day that the two roles that Frank Williams and Patrick Head held, team principal and technical director, both completely vacant going into the Christmas period at Williams, and literally no one at the head of the business, a rudderless ship, really. And of course, there is a structure there. There are plenty of other people, very capable people in that business. And I'm sure Dorrelton Capital, the owners who clearly made the decision to make the change, will be happy to say that they had a plan as to what they would do next. But the whole thing looks pretty fraught. As you know, Cotters, I spent a day with, or half a day with, Jos Capito for the magazine just a year ago, and he was in ebullient form. I have to say, the atmosphere that day when I arrived at the factory and met him and the people around him, and it was quite uplifting, because it was a sense of him bringing a new approach. He realized the team had some way to go to tackle its problems, and he felt he was the man for the job. And then, of course, he subsequently brought in François-Xavier de Maison as technical director, made a few other key appointments. But I remember distinctly him saying to me, "You know, Mark, I've only been in the job a few months. This is going to take some time." And here we are, you know, in the end, he was only given a relatively short time to do the job that was required. And I think that probably says quite a lot about the complexity of running Williams and turning it around. I think it also probably speaks to the urgency or the speed, at least the speed with which Dorrelton would like to see it turned around. I think the step back that the team took on track last year was hugely difficult for them to accept after what looked like, you know, progress the previous season. And then, as you say, you know, the appointment of James Bowles. So much about that appointment that is intriguing. It's not often that you read a press release from one team which quotes a team principal of another team. And, you know, to have Toto Wolff quoted at some length about his belief that, you know, James is a great appointment and would be, you know, terrific team principal. And then subsequently for Toto to go on and talk to, you know, to the media about the fact that there isn't anywhere for James Bowles to go within Mercedes, you know, unless he wants Toto's job and he's not about to leave that. So, you know, there was a, I thought that was very interesting. You read between the lines of it and you have to say that Williams clearly needed to appoint a leader, decided to go for youthful enthusiasm of a brand new team principal, someone who's never run a racing team, never run a racing team, never run a, certainly never run a Formula One team, and have gone for someone who's held in high esteem at Mercedes-Benz. He's been there all his, essentially all of that team's history since BAR days, BAR, Honda, became chief race, you know, race strategist at Brawn, Grand Prix when the team won the championship, both championships, and then in at the foundation of Mercedes. And as we know over the years, you know, James is a kind of guy who, he's not only a highly competent engineer, but is quite happy to shoulder the burden of responsibility. There've been a couple of notable incidents during his tenure as head of strategy at Mercedes where, you know, he's come on the radio to Lewis or whoever and just said, look, I take responsibility for that mess up today. So he's not just happy to take the credit, he'd also take responsibility. And I think that's a good sign of a leader. You know, he likes to be accountable and he's certainly extremely highly thought of by the leadership at Mercedes. But clearly, the sequence of events, when it all becomes clear, which it will do in the fullness of time, because people will eventually start to reveal the sequence of events, it certainly has all the hallmarks of a change of leadership, which was not that well planned. It's required Mercedes to cooperate to allow James to come into his role, which is why, you know, Toto's, I think, being quoted there. Essentially, he's supporting James and he's actually supporting Williams, and I think Toto continues to have a soft spot for Williams because, of course, let's not forget he invested there himself. I mean, Williams had an opportunity to become Toto Wolff's team before Mercedes-Benz ever got their hands on him. So, you know, he has a soft spot for Williams. He liked that opportunity when he came into Formula One. So I think, and obviously Williams is an important customer of Mercedes, so to put James in there is extremely good from that perspective as well. But, and I'll say this, perhaps hoping that James is listening to the podcast, it's a massive challenge. I'm sure he knows that. It's a massive challenge for an experienced team principal. I mean, let's face it, people far more experienced in running large, complex motorsport organizations have failed to reverse Williams' decline. James has a huge task in front of him. I think that, you know, he will need to surround himself with an incredibly strong team. He'll hopefully bring in some people that he can rely on, trust upon to help him to deliver his vision. He's now got to create that vision for the team, and he's got to create that vision in partnership with Dorrelton, because Dorrelton are the paymasters. By all accounts, they've just had to put about £36 million into the team in the last month. There's been a new issue of shares have gone into at Williams, about £36 million. Dorrelton ultimately will want to start to see this team turn around. It needs to turn around commercially, needs to turn around in terms of performance. you know, Latifi's gone. With Latifi going, you also lose the sponsorship that came from him. And then you've got the whole on-track scenario. And as you and I, Cotters, were talking about before we started recording the podcast, you know, turning around a team takes years. It's a long process. And in the next issue of the magazine, I take a look. I've written a feature on the, all the changes in the team principal roles, you know, the four major changes this winter, but also including the two changes which happened last year, Otmar Safnauer and Mike Crack. So that as we go into the start of the season, you know, six of the team principals were not in that role at that the team they're now in back in 2021. Only 14 principals 2 years ago were in the same roles that, that they now are. So there's a lot going on in leadership in F1. And James Vowles has got a huge, wonderful opportunity, but it brings with it a huge number of challenges. It would be too easy to say it's a poison chalice. I don't think everything at Williams is negative, not by a long way. Lots of good people who still work there. But as I've written about, not just in this column, but before, I think the thing at Williams is someone has got to win over the dressing room, get the alignment in that team, get people accepting that things need to change. And sort of one final thing I'll say is that I looked back on my notes from my interview with Jos Capito, and in fact, I played the recording of the interview yesterday just to remind myself of some of the things that he talked about. And I remember him specifically saying that there are too many people in Grove who talk about the fact that things are done in a certain way. And this is not the way we do them if you try to bring in change. And he said to me, you know, that has to change. We've got to be much more open, realize that Formula One's moved on, that we need to employ bright, fresh talent, bring new ideas, be innovative, be prepared to take some risks, no longer be a passenger in the Formula One journey, but to start taking a lead if we had to ever catch up with these phenomenal teams that have been dominating the sport for the last decade and a half. So, you know, he knew the extent of the challenge. He's no longer there. So everything that he's learned during his tenure is now gone, and it's pressing the reset button. And Matt, a bit like your crashed computer, you know, the question is, when you press the reset, does it restart and everything is miraculously back to normal? Or actually, do you discover that you have a rather more systematic, you know, failure? So good luck to James Vowles. It's a massive challenge in front of him.
Matt, in your column, you allude to speaking to an insider who opined that kind of what the team really needs is a whole load of people being sacked and new people hired in their place. Factional warfare sounds a little bit like a Ferrari of old. The whole management culture of this is how we do it. There is, of course, a song that goes along those lines, but also it reminds one of Britain in the 1970s. Not that you were, of course, alive in the 1970s, but as a fan of the carry-on genre, you will have seen, of course, Carry On at Your Convenience, which is a pitch-perfect satire on British industry in the 1970s.
I am a fan of certain elements of the 70s. In fact, I was trying to do it discreetly, but I have on my desk a collection of Scale Electrics cars. I noticed the rear wing of one of my sports cars from Le Mans in the 70s had fallen off. I was trying to discreetly put that back in place while Mark was chatting. But some things should very much be left in the 70s. Anyway, as for Vowles' appointment, sort of steer it back on. One of the constraints of a monthly magazine as beautiful as eye catching as a cover on GP Racing magazine is this week is obviously my column is almost completely out of date because it's very much based in the talking about Capito. We didn't know Vowles, and his appointment was as a genuine surprise. Mark says I was with a couple of colleagues at the Autosport shows and I was fastest finger first. So I unlocked my phone and read out the emails, and James Vowles joins Williams as team principal. A bit of a audible intake of breath. I think it's very interesting sort of seeing those Toto Wolff quotes, because they then, before the announcement dropped, Wolff actually had a conference call lined up, And then Vowles was part of it. And Vowles was saying, I will not turn Williams into a mini Mercedes, he said in the press call organised by Mercedes that featured motorsport, Mercedes motorsport boss Toto Wolff. You know, and during that call, they spent a lot of time talking about their working relationship together at Mercedes. So that was quite amusing. It's a very interesting appointment. I think, as Mark says about Dorilton sort of writing a cheque for another £36 million, I think it sort of dials down the flight risk around Dorilton, whether they were looking at this point in time after, you know, really, really sort of messing up the new rules and reverting to being the rank backmarker, whether they could have made essentially a quick buck. If you look at Liverpool at the minute, obviously owned by the FSG consortium, and it only takes one or two of the stakeholders to sort of get itchy feet, and then the company has to go up for sale unless you can bring in more capital. And Dorilton, it was a bit more of a closed shop than that, but as essentially a financial investment group, the same thing can happen. So you're wondering if behind the scenes a few people would think, well, you know, Drive to Survive has probably got a shelf life, and okay, once this Brad Pitt Formula One film's come out, is the commercial value going to drop off? Let's up sticks and sell now before we, you know, repaint Grove again and don't get anything out of it. So I think if they'd appointed someone, let's say, and no disrespect to him, he does one-on-one he does roundtable sessions at most Grand Prix, he's brilliant. But if they'd have promoted from within, say, Dave Robson, I think you could have held the suspicion that Dorilton might still be looking for the exit door. But by poaching a high-profile paddock figure like James Vowles, and obviously selling him the dream that yes, you will be team principal, but presumably he's going to go, well, hopefully it's for more than a year, 2 years, because you know it takes a long time to steer these big ships, so you know he's not going to see results right away. If, for example, there was a repeat of 2019 and the Williams, what are we on now, FW45, I think this will be, if that is not, for argument's sake, ready for the first day of testing, that cannot be held at James Vowles. So he'll want to be in the position for a certain length of time to show that he is taking him up the order, whether it's just the infrastructure still miles behind and he improves their pit stop or the execution of their strategy. He'll want to have the tangible gains to say he's done a good job. So I think there's reason to believe he's not been sold the dream around a year, so Dorilton will stay a bit longer. I also, as much as they have played down this link with Mercedes, I think, you know, when Albon signed for Williams initially, obviously as of this year, he's renewed his contract with them and he has dropped his Red Bull backing. But certainly around that time, there was some speculation whether Williams's relationship with Mercedes was by no means going frosty, but whether it was less pivotal, less ingrained than it once was, just because they were willing to allow this outside force from their greatest competitor to have an intimate knowledge of their powertrain. So by having a high up at Mercedes come, it sort of, you know, you can read into whether that realigns the two, because you would have to expect that they will now be political allies for the key votes, Williams and Mercedes. Yes, there's that customer engine relationship, and whether, you know, There is a written or uncodified understanding between Wolff and Vowles that they'll support each other in votes, you don't know. But presumably those two have worked together so long and cultivated so much success because they're singing from the same hymn sheet. So therefore they'll probably be aligned in the politics, even though one's at the top end of the table and the other is at the bottom. And the other thing I know, again, to refer back to this point of not creating a mini Mercedes, but essentially, if that is, Vowles has been there since it said, you know, BAR over the door, he will have seen that how you go from the shambles of Honda in 07 and 08 to Braun and then the sustained period of Mercedes success and things like the no blame culture. And they are obviously not exclusive to Mercedes. We know that Binotto tried to implement at Ferrari. It wasn't particularly widely received, which has led to him handing in his notice, and is also why in all those media calls he came over as defensive to a fault, because they're going, no, our strategy is absolutely perfect. Well, that's not quite what a no blame culture means, you know, there was a slight misinterpretation there. But anyway, that is the blueprint for how to run a successful Formula One team. So if in 12-18 months Williams does start to operate like that, and I think it's something Capito, I won't say failed, but probably didn't pull off, was removing a slightly more toxic culture. So if Vowels does that successfully and a few other things, and it does start to resemble the Mercedes structure, you might not necessarily say it's been made in Mercedes' image, but if that's all he knows and it's breeded success, then why not try to replicate that as best as possible?
There's always a feeling, isn't there, that someone will be aligned with someone they used to work for, isn't there? So, you know, it was fairly well known that Claire Williams would always vote with Toto or do what Mercedes said at meetings. And as you say, James Vowles having worked for Toto for many years. So even if they aren't working hand in glove, there will be the perception that they are. I mean, so we Matt, you and I were having a very good laugh over the weekend of the Autosport show about me being described in another Formula One magazine as one of Matt Bishop's stormtroopers. They'd even scanned my head, a picture of my head from Who Works, and stuck it on a stormtrooper's body.
Yes. A publication I would not even rip up to wipe my bottom with.
I found it highly amusing, and I don't mind at all. But you got to laugh, haven't you? Anyway, let's move on. We did discuss valuations, something that's come up just over the past few days before we record this. Talk of the Formula One business being valued at $20 billion and potentially being up for sale. And if that were to happen, that would be a big profit for Liberty. But we have the FIA president stomping on that with a vengeance and saying that's not the right valuation. So what do we make of this in terms of the valuation of an outfit like Williams and how that plays into our discussion of the way the current owners see it? You know, are they thinking, yeah, we can still turn a profit out of this, or are they now sort of having to sort of double down? Because my interpretation of Capito being hired was that it was a play, perhaps, to appeal to perhaps the Volkswagen Audi group that he'd worked with before, and that there may have been some disappointment when Volkswagen Audi went with another organisation entirely.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that you never know when you employ an executive who's worked with another company is whether he's left on good terms or bad terms or slightly indifferent terms. And obviously he'd been with Volkswagen, the Volkswagen group, super successful in World Rally. Of course, you also think triple back-to-back titles. And, you know, he's a motorsport guy through and through. And like you, I have to say, I did think surely his little black book, certainly under the letter V, would have some pretty good names he could call up and perhaps try and woo Audi to Williams or Porsche. And so far that hasn't happened. I think the other thing that's interesting is when Andretti came sniffing around trying to buy an existing team, again, I felt that Williams could be a marriage made in heaven. You know, there's good relationships there that date back quite some way. I'm talking about personal relationships, family relationships. Obviously, the Williams family and the Andretti family know each other well. So I'm going back a few years, you know, prior to the Dorrington takeover, I kind of always thought that might be an option. And even then after Dorrington, I thought, well, maybe Michael will go to Grove and suggest a Williams-Andretti tie-up, that kind of thing. That hasn't happened. You have to assume there's been a conversation, and therefore, the more we see of it, and going back to the points that Matt made earlier on, Dorrington look like they're in this at least in the medium term, if not indeed long term. And why would they? Well, I mean, Dorrington's not a private equity group, it's a private family fund. So behind this fund is a family, which means it's very likely an individual who has decided to go for this and wants to presumably have a combination of the fun and satisfaction and the challenge of owning and running a Formula One team, but then also seeing it grow and in the fullness of time become a very successful commercial venture. Well, at the moment, has Williams gone up in value since they bought it? It's probably gone up in value just because the whole of Formula One has gone up in value. So, you know, anybody who wants to buy an F1 team would necessarily be paying more today than when Dorrington came in and bought Williams for, quite frankly, what was a bit of a bargain, and certainly looks like that It looked like that at the time. It looks even more so with the passage of time and everything we've seen over the last couple of years. So Darlington's kind of at a point now where I would have thought they know that there are not going to become fewer buyers for Formula One teams in the coming years. They're only likely to become more potential buyers, investors. Alpine, for example, have been looking for an investment for their F1 team. Looks like they're going to get it from a combination of Saudi Arabia and China, Geely and Aramco coming. So there's all kinds of possibilities I would think will come out of the woodwork. We know that there are institutional investors in America who are seeing what Liberty have done and are thinking, well, actually, we say institutional investors, I'm talking about really more pure investment companies who have sport within their portfolio, and the opportunity to buy a stake in Williams at some point could be very attractive. And that's a good way for Darlington to realize quite a lot of return, not to sell the whole team, but to sell a third or 40% or something like that. That could be quite an interesting thing. Of course, McLaren sold a chunk of the Formula One team to an investment company to raise some useful funds. So, you know, the Williams could do the same thing. So my look at it is that we're probably still closer to the beginning of Darlington's involvement in Formula One than towards the end of it. There are only three directors of that team. One is Matthew Savage from Darlington. Another is James Matthews, who we've talked about before. He's kind of been a strategic advisor to them, of course, known in the UK for both being an extremely good racing driver in his own right, held a number of records in racing when he raced for Manor in Formula Renault and won the British Championship early in his career, but then had a super successful career in private equity. And so James knows motorsport, and his father, David Matthews, was a very successful touring car driver back in the 60s and 70s. So, you know, James comes from a family that understands motorsport, understands business. Matthew Savage has obviously got a remit from the family fund to do whatever it is that they plan to do with his team. And I think the appointment of James Vowles, to me, looks like very much a way to set out a new stall for the team. This, you know, to try and drive the team in a new direction. And to be perfectly honest, I think it should be quite happy if they became a mini Mercedes in the fullness of time. That would be a pretty good trajectory to go in, I would have thought. So valuation of a team. Well, I mean, Zak Brown, I think over a year ago, said Formula One team valuations were heading towards $1 billion. I think they're probably at least halfway there across the whole board. That's as an average across Formula One. You know, I think I think valuations of teams really have been climbing. Finn Rousing wasn't particularly eager to sell Sauber Motorsport to Andretti at a knockdown price. I think he was right not to do that. And I think the valuations in F1 teams and the awareness of the fact that this is now a time of a surge in growth. I mean, a phenomenal surge in growth in Formula One. And this is another reason why the teams are not falling over themselves to allow Michael Andretti in, because his $200 million, you know, upfront payment does now look decidedly light compared to the valuation of teams and the growth of the championship. And whether you want to argue that Formula One has doubled in value and is worth $15 billion, or whether it's a bit more than that and it's worth $20 billion, there's no question Formula One is worth a heck of a lot more than when Liberty bought it because of what they've done in five short years. And I think this is why there's resistance to Andretti coming in, not because anyone has a problem with the Andretti family or the name, but because of the pie, the way the pie has grown, the fact that, of course, other people want to come in and have a slice of the pie. Why wouldn't they? We'd all love to have a Formula One team now, because they've turned from being a liability into being an asset. So valuation and teams just going up and up. And whether it's a team at the back of the grid like Williams, or whether it's a team at the front of the grid like Red Bull or Mercedes, or indeed even parts of their teams, you know, Red Bull powertrains. Christian Horner manages to find a partner for Red Bull powertrains. The number, you know, the number allocated, the number associated with that will be a healthy number. And it'll probably be, I mean, I'd say you'd probably to invest in Red Bull powertrains is probably not dissimilar in amount of money than to have bought the whole of the Williams Formula One team just a couple of years. You know, it's a couple of hundred million at least. So value's going up, and and there's no shortage of, there is no shortage of interested parties out there. I was in America last week. While I was in America, I met a couple of groups who talked to me about their interest in Formula One. Neither group is involved, never has been involved, but my goodness, in the United States, Formula One as a sport is not just on the radar. It's a massive blip in the center of the radar for sports businesses, for sponsors, for investors. And I think to some extent, because Formula One's so still so Eurocentric as a sport, you know, the teams, the management, the leaders, I think the awareness that America's become big, I don't think actually we realize just how big it's become. It is massive in the United States. And that's why Liberty has such confidence over having three Grand Prix, of investing in Miami, of investing in Las Vegas. We're some way up an extraordinary period of growth for the sport.
Well, if we steer away from the subject of Filthy Luca right now, not a nickname of former Ferrari president Luca de Montezemolo. We've courted controversy in this month's GP racing by assembling a panel of Formula One experts, not just scrubby journalists, but engineers and stuff like that as well. They have voted on the 50 fastest drivers of all time. A number of the panelists have worked with some of the drivers in the list and witnessed their excellence firsthand. Clearly, it's not a scientific process because we're not comparing people driving the same car. As I believe we mentioned in the feature, unfortunately, Juan Manuel Fangio and several other people of his generation are not available at the moment to drive back-to-back in the same car as the likes of Max Verstappen. We're not counting trophies or weighing up, I'm going to make the inverted commas sign here, greatness. It's purely about who was quick, not necessarily the most successful. A few months ago, Formula One and Amazon Web Services came up with a list along these lines. So interesting to see that their data-driven survey sort of had a crossover with ours. Obviously theirs was data driven and it only went back as far as 1983, so you had people like Heikki Kovalainen on it who did not feature on our list. How did we do it? Well, we approached various people. New Ferrari team principal Frederic Vasseur was one of the panel. They voted for their 20 fastest drivers in order. We applied a point score to that. And once everyone's votes had come together, we counted them up and that's where we got. So are our guests in agreement with the list? Matt Q, you've seen a number of these drivers go firsthand. What was your take on the list? Was it a case of, as various people knee-jerk responded on Twitter, typical biased British journalism, despite the fact that there were French, Dutch, Italian, Indian people on the panel?
Well, I don't want to give any spoilers away because, of course, I want listeners to go and pop down to WH Smith and pay for their copy of GP Racing magazine. But a British driver wasn't number one, so I'm not sure that's quite a fair allegation to hold against the people that have compiled this piece. Interesting scoring system, very much so. I'm a road car fan, I suppose. I follow the industry and also the journalism, and that's very much how sort of Autocar and whoever else, Evo magazine, do their car of the year. They sort of do this aggregate scoring system. In a former role at Autosport, I used to be responsible for compiling the top 50 drivers of the year, and obviously people be very biased towards their own series and go, no, I think they should be, you know, second. It's like, well, no, they've done three races and in a crackpot series, whatever, so no. But so the criteria we had to come back at one another is like, you can argue your driver up as long as you can make a valid case for someone else coming down. That's how it works. You can't have five people in second position. So I went through the list and I struggled in several places to, you know, where I thought a few people were out of position. I struggled to make the case for anyone ahead of them to come down sort of substantially. So I think that in the first instance, that grounds it as a very good list, if I may say so. So a hat tip to Luke Smith, who's bylines on it. A few people, if I go through sort of some of my initial reactions, I won't give too much away because, again, you know, you need to like and subscribe to get the full content.
Smash that like button.
Absolutely.
Yes.
But I thought initially that Ronnie Peterson might have been out of sync compared to some of his contemporaries, where there was a bit of his rapid reputation favouring there. And again, I'd maybe say someone like Graham Hill or Giuseppe Farina maybe being a bit too high, but obviously you know, I've only seen them in the textbooks because I'm so young, so my appreciation is probably a bit out of whack. Same sort of the reputation around one word, Kimi Räikkönen is probably doing him a few favours, but then again, I was pleased to see, you know, Stellan Beloff feature well, you know, the hill that a lot of F1 fans like to die on is, you know, Monaco 84. Forget Senna. Look at Beloff. He was the quick driver that day and things like that. So I think on the whole, it was a very pleasing
driving
list.
An illegal car, if I might interrupt there.
Quite. But yeah, not too many disagreements. The other way I looked at it is if you go to sort of the mid 20s and 30s, you think, let's say, I'm trying to pick up a couple of names here. Again, we're not giving too much away, but if you have, say, Jack Brabham and Jean Alesi, let's pick those two as names. So, if, you know, if I bet my house on those two drivers, I would probably want Jean Alesi of the two to set that blistering qualifying lap. And he ranks ahead of Jack Brabham in that list. So again, sort of without blowing smoke too far your way, Connors, I thought it was a very, very good list. I didn't have much to call out on it. I was interested especially in some of the ratios, the qualifying differentials to teammates. It's well supported by stats. So I've got a lot of praise. Yes, a lot of praise for the list.
One thing that stood out for me, and as it turned out, my illustrious predecessor as well, judging by the volume of WhatsApp messages he sent me over the weekend, the presence of Daniel Ricciardo ahead in the list of the driver who spent the past couple of seasons blowing him away on track is a little bit of an outlier. But apart from that, it does all seem very logical. We've done very well without giving away any spoilers so far. But let's see if Mark can manage to not issue any spoilers.
Well, I have to name drop and say that yesterday I received an email from Jacques Villeneuve, and I will not be sending him this top 50 for him to read through because he's not even on it, which is the one spoiler I will share with you. And I must say, I read the list and thought it was absolutely fascinating. Such a difficult thing to do. So much subjectivity around this topic of, you know, who's the greatest and working at the top 50. I think the fact that the piece gives a context to the methodology is really good, because once you frame it in that way and say, okay, so we've tried to create at least a measure, a benchmark of sorts, that means you can really stand behind that. I think that's really good. And then when you go through the list, I must say I found it very thought-provoking. I think one of the things that really appeals to me about the list is, you mentioned the AWS survey, which went back to 1983. I have no idea why they stopped in 1983. Do you know why they did that? Is it because was there no data before 1983?
Because it's a FOM thing. You know, so far as FOM is in some way concerned, yeah. Formula One didn't happen before 1983. It sprang into existence.
So
there was something else called Grand Prix racing.
Yeah, so I love the fact that this is as comprehensive as it is, because there are names in the top 50 that, you know, I'm thinking about someone like Maston Gregory or I was going to say Pedro Rodriguez, but that's no surprise really. But, you know, Maston Gregory is one that stood out for me because, you know, read about him and know about him, and it's just nice to see him on a 2023 list, you know, make the grade. I also went through the list, and I've been very fortunate to work in Formula One either with or competing against or observing 23 of the 50. But that in itself is great, because that means there's 27 people on this list that I haven't seen race other than on TV. So that shows that over the 73-year history of the sport, there's been a very even spread in terms of the drivers that you've looked at. And again, that's a really good way to go about this, because all too often when you see top 10s, top 20s, greatest of all times, all of that, particularly social media votes, I mean, my goodness, everyone's voting for people who, you know, been in the sport for the last 15 years. You know, it's as if the first five decades of Formula One never occurred, or any of the context within which drivers were competing in Formula One at that time in cars that were inherently unreliable with far fewer races in the season. And by the way, your career sometimes ended with a life-changing injury or the loss of your life. You know, so when you see the top 50 and you see the, and I'm not going to give the order, but, you know, you see mention in the listings of, you know, François Sever, who, you know, was a great young driver and being mentored by Sir Jackie Stewart, whose career ended, you know, Jackie's career ended because he went to the scene of that accident and as a result didn't compete in that Grand Prix. And it became a pivotal, I think that was a pivotal moment in Formula One history, actually, the Sever, François Sever accident, his death, and Jackie's decision to retire on the spot and to continue his campaigning for safety. And of course, Jochen Rindt, you know. So I really like the listing, because you go through it. And yes, of course, there are a couple of surprises. I went straight to number one to see who had been chosen. and was kind of, wow, okay, well, that's, you know, that's that will raise some debate. And then I went and looked at two and three, and I thought, actually, that's a pretty good top three. You know, that's a difficult top three to argue with. And then as I went into, you know, further down into the top 10, a couple of, like Matt said, you know, it's a couple of people you think is slightly out of position. I've always felt that, you know, and I mentioned Jacques Villeneuve earlier on, I've always felt that Gilles, while undoubtedly being a very fast driver, and this is all about this is the quick list, it's not the consistent list, you know, it's right that he should, you know, be well placed in the list. But, you know, there are other people. I mean, I remember when I came into Formula One, you know, my first race that I worked at was a Dutch Grand Prix in 1983, and Gilles obviously had lost his life the previous year, but I had seen Gilles race, albeit very briefly, at the British Grand Prix in 1981. And when I started working in F1, I often found as many people who would say Gilles Villeneuve is a complete liability, and it's just because a few particularly influential media became big mates with him that he, and then he died in a car, his reputation suddenly became enormous. And you know, I have distinct recollection of moments with media in the mid-1980s who had a different take on what's become the Villeneuve, the myth, you know, the myth and the man of that is Gilles Villeneuve. So there's so much in this that's really interesting to look at, but I think it's extremely well put together because of the context. Really fascinating. And I can tell you that there will be a few drivers who will look at it, who will be delighted to see how they're being framed. There'll also be one or two who'll be really, truly pissed off because they'll be much further down or not even in it. I mean, that's the other thing. There'll be a few people not even in it who I can think of who will be just who will be just appalled. But there you go. The context, I think it's extremely well put together.
I await an internet letter from Heikki Kovalainen and Jarno Trulli. But, you know, it was, you know, it was not a scientific exercise. We said that there was an element of optics no matter what your makeup is of the jury. So we sort of said that this is how we're working it out. Elsewhere in the, because it's a speed themed issue, we did it a bit more scientifically because we could. So we ranked the 2022 grid in speed order. Obviously there are variances in terms of car characteristics, etc. No one's going to win a coconut for predicting Max Verstappen at one end and Nicholas Latifi at the other. But in between, there are some surprising results. And you'll be very pleased to know, I certainly was, when I received it, Alex Kalinauskas submitted his workings out in the form of a spreadsheet alongside the copy with multiple tabs. So it's...
delightful.
It is as scientific. It's as scientific as it can possibly get, given that people are all in different cars and we've eliminated outliers and wet races and various things like that, and races where people pitted right at the end for sticky tyres to in order to secure a point for fastest lap, that sort of thing. There was some debate over whether to do that for qualifying versus race, but I kind of felt that probably over the course of the year, race performances would probably be a bit more consistent and represent the bigger picture. But once again, our previous editor disagreed in one of his other WhatsApp messages and says, "Why didn't you use qualifying?" But I said, "I'm in charge now." We also look at last year's fastest pit stops and whether they actually made a blind bit of difference to the race outcome. And Matt Q looked at last year's pit stops. So given that you're in the room, were you surprised about what you found and what did you learn? You can give out a few spoilers, but spread them thinly.
Okay. I have to say I was surprised. I sort of, when you sent me the very thorough and detailed commission for it, Connors, I was expecting to be sort of tripping over incidences where the 10th or two saved had determined two cars sort of pitting one behind the other and a change of position, or at the very least them coming out side by side and people being given 5 second penalties for unsafe releases. I suppose the reason we think of that is because they're the glossy highlights that Sky will show over and over again, but the truth is there weren't any of those. So we did it as a scoring system, and like driver ratings or something like that, I mapped out in the Pret a Monge of King's Cross the criteria 1 to 10, what would that fulfill, and I wrote those criteria really before going through the 22 fastest pit stops, expecting to have a nice good spread, and again, without giving much away, there was no 10 out of 10s. There was one or two results sort of in the 5 to 10 range, but most of them were down at the bottom. What's the point in attaching all four tyres quicker than anyone else if the engine's going to detonate at the cost of 50 laps as opposed to, 50 milliseconds or and so on. So I was quite surprised. I wasn't surprised to see that Red Bull and McLaren are the informed teams with a smattering of sort of Ferrari and Alpine appearances, because again, just by following F1 closely, you pick that up. There's a good bit in the sidebar you commissioned me for to learn from Andrea Seidel, saying, okay, our infrastructure's not ready yet and our cars are stepped backwards, but if we can rehearse our pit stops over and over, we can give ourselves a morale boost by showing that in some aspects of the team, yes, we're already ready to compete with Ferrari, Mercedes and Red Bull. I found that interesting. But I would say it was a fascinating exercise to do, to sift through the data. But I was a little bit underwhelmed, I have to say, that, for something that... because the logic has always been that, nail your pit stop because it's better to save half a second in the pit lane, avoiding a sticky wheel nut, than to ask your drivers to bang in a string of qualifying laps and risk biffing it into the wall. And that still holds true. I was just disappointing to, see that the instances, where Max Verstappen, if he hadn't have had a quick stop, then Charles Leclerc would have won. I suppose, But then again, that speaks to certain things we saw with the how quick the RB18 and Max Verstappen were, where Red Bull could have a clanger of a pit stop, like the 11-second job in Austin, and Verstappen can still come back to win. So pit stops are a precise art. To interrupt myself again, to quote Murray Walker, I was baffled in my research, going through transcripts, I was baffled to learn that AlphaTauri rotate their cast all the time. So the front wing, or the front jack person, is then the right rear on the tyre gun, you know, one week to the next. I cannot fathom the logic behind that. You know, you want master of traits, not jack of all trades. So I couldn't work that out. But I was just surprised to learn that, costly as they are when you don't get them right, how little influence, I suppose, they do have in the real key decisions. I think there's probably only three or four races I picked out where so much as a change for position would have been determined by, you know, that front right Pirelli going on a little bit quicker than the person behind.
One of the things about pit stops is, first of all, they're mandatory, so it's not an option. You have to do it. It then becomes something that you can lose time at, but you're not actually necessarily going to make time. Everyone's going to have a pit stop. Everyone, more or less, on any given day will do an adequate 2 to 3 second pit stop. But if you screw it up, you can lose 10 seconds, 15 seconds, half a minute, whatever. So I think pit stops are probably less about how much time you can make up and more about how much time you can not lose by making a mess of it. So the consistency really is key. I think there's another important element which you've touched on, which is, you know, your comment about Andrea Seidel and you know, McLaren's ambitions. When you're a midfield team, the pit stop can become an incredibly important morale boosting moment for the team. You're not going to win races, you're not going to win a championship, but you can be the best pit crew, or you can be as good as the, you know, within a tenth of Red Bull. And that gives, that actually has a disproportionate impact on team morale, both at the track with the guys and girls in the garage, but also back at base, because, you know, if you finish seventh or ninth, then you say, but actually we were the second quickest pit stop of the weekend. That gives you something to celebrate. So I think there's a human, the pit stop is such a human activity in the middle of a technological sport. There's an opportunity on that level playing field of 10 teams of 22 people to say, actually, yes, okay, so our car's not that quick, but when it comes to pit stops and teamwork, we're as good as anybody. So there's a couple of elements around that. But I think that's a really nice conclusion, that actually a tenth or two here and there in a pit stop isn't actually going to make that much of a difference. And in that respect, I always think of, Andy Stevenson, who's sporting director at Aston Martin, of course, worked with me at Jordan. I remember Andy giving a garage tour to a group of guests and talking about, you know, to do a pit stop, well, you have to slow down to speed up. It's all about the consistency. It's not a question of what can we knock half a second, a tenth of a second off. It's about the fact that every time either car comes in, that we can service it, do what's required, get it back into the race and waste the least amount of time. So really, really interesting to look at it. And, definitely puts perhaps a slightly different perspective on what it is that the commentators are screaming about when pit stops happen.
Well, consistency is king, isn't it? Because, you know, we have a team like Ferrari, which has these marvellous sort of spikes in pit stop speed. As Matt said, there's a couple of instances of Ferrari having fastest pit stop in a race in our list. But at the same time, if you're Carlos Sainz and Charles Leclerc, imagine being one of those guys and heading into the pits and not knowing if you're going to get one of those pit stops or some horrendous absolute meltdown.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing Frederic Vasseur on the front left, you know, in the first, in Bahrain, trying to get, but you know, but this actually comes back again to this point, isn't it? It's about, you know, Ferrari had such a quick car last year, but where did they get let down? They got let down on strategy. They got let down on reliability, and they definitely got let down on sort of operations, you know, including in the pit lane. And, And these then become, this becomes the areas where instead of having marginal gains, you have marginal losses, and the marginal losses add up to you being properly uncompetitive. So that gives the team principals and the team managers something to focus on, just to make, just basically to make sure not to screw up.
Well, we'll hope they can dial that out under Fred Vassar. We shall see. There will be some stuff coming up about that in over the next couple of issues. There are plenty more other things to read in the latest issue of GP Racing, but it's time for us to abandon ship and carry on work on the season preview issue, which is going to be its usual bumper self on the shelves 10 days before the season opening Grand Prix. So it will be hitting the newsstands just about the same time as testing starts. So it's time for me to say thank you to my guests. Mark, you can go to bed now, have maybe a sip of some of that fine local red lager.
No, actually, Cotters, I've got a hard taskmaster who wants me to file my column, which I'm going off to finish writing. I've also got to just have a final read of that feature on the team principal merry-go-round that we've got in the next issue, and then I'll be firing them over to you. So I'll be burning the late night oil here in Australia. But yes, don't feel too sorry for me, because I will have a glass of something suitably intoxicating by my side.
Fabulous. Yeah, speaking of hard taskmasters, our managing editor's probably wondering, how long does it take to record a podcast? Matt Q, you have a slightly more relaxed deadline with your next column. We'll be hearing from you next week. And hopefully circumstances won't render its contents a little bit behind the times by the time it lands on the shelves.
I know. I've got a bit busy day until I get round to the column for various commitments for Autosport and filing what Collars you would call a tissue of lies, my expenses. And then I've got a little bit of annual leave coming up. So of course the way I lean into that is with meeting Armageddon this afternoon. So a lot to plough through in the meantime, but it's been a pleasure to have your company, both of you, to keep me sane prior to that.
Oh dear. Well, as Matt Q sails off into meeting Armageddon, this podcast is going to sail off into its edit at the hands of our long-suffering producer, Martin Lee. Don't forget to check out our latest subscriptions offers at gpracing.com. Snap them up now. You know, cost of living, who knows when the price of paper is going to rise. If you are wanting to buy a copy in the linear fashion on the newsstands, don't forget you can find out your nearest stockists on seymour.co.uk. That's Seymour spelled as in one of the, I believe, the surviving wife of Henry VIII. So we'll speak to you next month. Thank you very much for listening.